Maybe just before we start, just a couple things to just note. I think the important thing to always keep in mind with the church's teaching is that everything she really teaches about, it falls under a category. Everything's a gift. Everything's a gift. And so when we think about a gift, when someone gives us a gift, we're not going to take it, stomp on it, and walk away from the person who just gave it. That would be an offense. We take it with thanksgiving. We take it with joy, with awe, and we respect it. And so this is really an underlying theme behind all of the church's teachings on life issues, ethics, just war theory, etc. It's recognizing the gift of creation, the gift of the human person, and the gift of our life. If we understand everything as a gift, it starts to change things. And it helps us to begin to be thankful for everything we have. And the other thing is, there's a lot of things that happen in our culture around us. I preached about this slightly a few weeks ago when I was preaching on baptism. About our culture, really, I think the most fundamental aspect of our culture that would perhaps be antithetical to Catholicism is a culture of success. What's your dignity? Well, if you're a doctor or a lawyer, not that it's bad to be a lawyer or anything like that, but our culture says that you're only dignified if you have success. I was talking to Tom about this a bit at the break here, actually. I don't know, I've been thinking about this a lot. Like, I'll just throw this out here first. I love Breaking Bad. It is one of my favorite, it's actually my favorite show of all time. It's an amazing show. Because, yes, we were binging on it in October at the seminary. What's great about the show is that it's a show about this man and his search for success. He was not happy with family life. He was not happy with the life he had. He wanted to be successful at something, and he found something he was successful with, making methamphetamines. And he did a good job at it. He was successful. But the great thing about the show is that it shows the tragedy. It shows the logical conclusion of seeking that type of life out. Because he becomes a man who sees that this does not bring fulfillment. And in fact, the things that he, by seeking out, it actually destroys the things that were actually important in his life. Family, friends, etc. Success is not the arbiter of our lives. Our vocations, our fundamental vocations is what's there. So marriage, priesthood. These are vocations that God has given us. And we, by living out this life ethic, we're saying yes to God's will in our life in this moment. So, for example, my grandpa was a janitor his whole life. In the eyes of the world, that is not successful. You hear it today from teachers, I don't want to work at McDonald's. It's too low. It's not successful in the eyes of the world. But I would say my grandpa was actually successful in the eyes of the church. It's the success of Christianity. It's the success of doing that which is necessary for the sake of your vocation. I say this because often a pregnancy becomes a burden to success. Or when you're getting sick and dying, you're no longer successful. Life no longer has meaning. That is a cultural attitude that really digs deep in all of us. And we all fall victim to it. We all fall victim to it. My victimhood is that I'm always trying to seek successful grades in school. Because the world says you have to do really well at school. Now, I like to study. I'm a nerd that way. But that spirit plays itself out in me. And I think if we look deep in our hearts, it plays itself out in all of us. And so that's why sometimes people will find this life ethic offensive. Because it speaks against that spirit of our Western world. So the church is trying to offer a different vision of life, a whole different vision of life. And it's a life that's formed by the cross. But you can't have the resurrection without the cross. So we need to start to see the cross as the path to true life. And seeing that cross as a gift that God has given us so that we too can share in that glorious life He wants to give us. Finally, just one little side point is we also get very culturally narrow-minded. We don't think about other cultures. So, for example, in Africa, a child is always seen as a gift. I know I have a lot of friends from Africa who they'll say that over and over again. And also, people who are poor tend to actually be the happiest. I spent the last year working with the poor, and I can guarantee you that they have their struggles, and they have, but there's a deep sense of joy sometimes in some of these people that we do not have, because when they receive something, they're truly grateful for it. They understand gift more than we do. So these are things to kind of keep in mind as we talk about this, because some of these things may be offensive to some people, and that's okay. This is new, and that's okay. We're here to fight it out, and you're going to fight out, and that's okay to fight it out with it. Think about it. Ask questions. And if you think about something 3 weeks from now, you see, like myself, a father, or someone from RCA, ask deeper questions. Go on the internet. Search it out. The church has thought about these things, and like when she's putting together documents on this stuff, she's doing her research. She has so we have the Pontifical Academy for Life, for example. That's on the board of directors are some of the best doctors in the world. So they're backing their position up with the best science. The church is not against these things. She sees these things as necessary to help promote her own way of life and her own vision of the world. Okay, so that's my spiel. Questions? No questions now. All right, yes. Travis, yes.
On the slideshow, it says that Pentecostal Christianity is one of the most private thoughts.
Louise?
It can be catechism.
Okay.
What are the habits of thought?
I think it's being atheist. Isn't it being atheist?
Well, it...
It's like it's your religion or habit of thought. Thoughts that I thought, not that I can get.
It would be a rich question of catechism.
Okay. I mean, I would say, like, a habit of thought, it's really just maybe, like, a worldview. Yeah. Right? A philosophy of life. It's something that you... consistently assented towards. So the church is not saying because you think differently than us, you're less of a person. Any other questions? Yes.
They were talking about the other thing, taking Ebba Dine, and for one of your homilies, you actually explained when you were in the States, your experience. Mm-hmm. You don't know if everyone
else did that. So I spent the last year working with the Missionaries of Charity. The Missionaries of Charity are Mother Teresa's order. And so for 6 months, I was in Gallup, New Mexico, where they have a soup kitchen and shelter. But for the last 3.5 months, which was the most profound for me, was in San Francisco, actually. It initially started off as an AIDS residence for men dying from AIDS. That was one of the core places where the AIDS outbreak happened. When the house first opened, they weren't even sure how AIDS was transmitted, but the sisters were there. And they were there, and it was just a house of residence. They didn't have all the medications, so often people were dying there. It slowly has transformed into a hospice now, in which we have AIDS residents, and the AIDS residents aren't people who are dying, they're just there trying to get their life back on track, but it's also a place for people who die, who come there for dying. So we did have 3 people who died from AIDS complications due to AIDS, but that's because they weren't taking their medication. So, I mean, I have a whole whack of experiences from that week, from that 3.5 months, I mean, but... Like there was 1 week where we had 6 guys die in 5 days. And that was, I remember the end of the week, I was done. I was not done with being there, but I had given everything I possibly could. And actually, I remember going to adoration that night at the sisters' convent. I just put my head up against the wall in the sacristy, just putting my elbow on, I'm just dead tired. I said, Jesus, I have nothing left to give. Because I didn't. I was up late at night, I was up early in the morning, I was cleaning dead bodies, I was doing funerals, I was trying to take care of the guys who were still alive. And I just was done. But it was actually, that was one of the most profound hours of adoration I've ever had, because I had nothing to give. I could only receive from Christ. But what I found beautiful about there is everyone had people around, because the people who die there are people who have no one to care for them. They have no family. They really don't have friends. Or they don't have the financial resources to get a hospice to die in. They have nowhere to get the care that they need while they die. So the sisters open this place up so that these men can come in and have a place where they can die in peace, where they can receive the care they need, and you're giving them the care. Like there are things I did those 3.5 months that I never thought I'd be able to do, like give suppositories. Giving suppositories to AIDS patients? It's scary. You do double glove, but these are scary things. Or we have one guy with, I think it's, I'm not a medical person. I think it was like a third degree wound, so it was an open wound that went to the bone. Because he was bedridden on his bottom. I had to, every day, the first day, sister's like, okay, I'm going to teach you how to do this. I'm like, I don't think I can do this. Because I had to wipe the pus out every day. And I had to put a new bandage on every day. So I had to do it two or three times a day if it wasn't, because we wanted to try and get the wound into a more manageable condition. But the beautiful thing about those whole 3.5 months, every single guy, we had 13 guys pass away while I was there. Every single one of them passed away in peace. They were suffering. We did everything we could to alleviate their suffering. In fact, sister, sometimes the hospices weren't giving us the drugs we needed to help alleviate. The hospice system works a bit different there, but so we'd have these hospices. We would actually be just the place where they would get the care from the nurses who'd come in from these different hospices. And sometimes they weren't giving us the medication necessary to relieve the pain. And that was really frustrating because they were on some sort of government insurance that wasn't paying a whole lot, and so the hospices wouldn't make as much money off of that. Or the drug companies wouldn't make as much money off of that. And sister was getting very angry sometimes, and myself too, because they weren't getting everything they needed. But they all died in peace. It was the first time I was actually in the room when someone passed away. That was a very powerful experience. But it was always in peace. Why? Because they were loved for. They were cared for. And it was something beautiful. They never complained that they wanted it to end now. And some of these guys were in a lot of pain. Like one of them had AIDS dementia. Try controlling a guy with AIDS dementia. It's not an easy thing. You can't reason with them. It's impossible. It's actually impossible. Reason is thrown out the window. But what's beautiful about it all is none of them, they'll complain that they're suffering. They'll complain that they're hurting. But it's always done in peace. And you always have the sisters praying around them. And we had deathbed conversions. We had guys baptized on their deathbed. Like, it was an amazing experience. And what I just found beautiful about it was that this is, I don't actually, just as a side note, I hate the sentence, the phrase, death with dignity. Death is not a dignified thing. That's why we want to run away from it. That's why we want to avoid it. It's not dignified. But I do think you can say something about a beautiful death. That you've died well. And that it's been done accepted in a way that's accepting. And all the men who came in there may not have been accepting of the fact that they were dying. But through our work with them, because it wasn't just medical care, it was spending time with them, doing activities with them, praying with them if they wanted to be prayed with. We never forced things upon them. But they always wanted it in the end. They always wanted it. I think what happened is that slowly they would come to accept that they were dying. And they would accept the care. Sometimes they'd come in, the most hardened people you would ever meet, and they would die a saint. It was a beautiful experience. And so, yeah, it was, I mean, I could talk on and on and on about it. But does this give you a sense about, I think, why the church, because it's not in our control. And I think if some of these guys had the opportunities to end their lives on their own terms, would not have died in a peaceful way. But they came there to be able to die in a peaceful way. You need to give them that opportunity to die in peace. Other questions? Yes.
That list of people which you described, that every human person has dignity, this right, that, and so on, it's super sexual orientation. I mean,
yeah.
It's something that people speak about very identity. Could you speak to that, please?
Yeah, we don't discriminate about the sexual orientation. Just because, like, for example, let's say one has a homosexual orientation, that doesn't mean that they are less dignified. The church will never say that, ever. With that whole topic, I mean, we tend to think that because we criticize certain actions, we don't agree with certain actions, that we're judging the person. Our culture, again, we seem to think that our actions define who we are. What's the first question you ask when you meet someone? What do you do? What do you do? How do you act? Or what do you do? Like, what's your job? This is what defines us. This is how we see ourselves as defined. So it becomes easy to see how when I say to do X is wrong, and you do X, that I'm thus criticizing who you are as a person. That's not the case. It's a difficult thing to do because their mind might not be there yet. But the church does not discriminate in terms of sexual orientation. So what that means is that the church does not say you have less dignity, and you have every right to be a Christian just as everyone else does. And you have a right to life. You have a right to pursue a life, to pursue a career, etc. Like there should be no discrimination in this regard at all. What the church does discriminate against, if you will, is moral actions. Just as she discriminates against premarital sex, she does discriminate against homosexual sex for a variety of reasons. And the reason for that is the church's vision of marriage. The church's vision of marriage is that it's to be something that unifies a couple. So it helps the couple themselves. And it's for the procreation of children. Sex is not just about love. There is the end of the procreation of children, of creating children, it's a sign of union. In a perfect world, obviously. It means some people cannot have children. But if you're able to have children, this is a great way. This is the sign of that union. And so the church does say that. But you can be gay and be Catholic. You can be gay. The church, and there are. I actually have some friends who are both gay and Catholic. They're chaste. You see, Cardinal Collins said it a few years ago, we all have three or four major sinful tendencies in our life that we all struggle with. Every single one of us. No one's exempt from it. And even the Catechism says homosexual orientation can be a great cross for many people. And this, we have to be compassionate about it, and we must be caring, and we must be willing to see sometimes the suffering that is involved with that. And just talking to my friends about it, it's just difficult. But it's no more difficult than maybe someone who is addicted to pornography and wanting to get out of that life. It's just as difficult to do that as it is with this one. But we all have those things we struggle with. Some people struggle majorly with lying or creating up false images about the world around them and stuff like that. Some people struggle really actually with stealing. Like, we all have them. And we all have to struggle against them because there's different aspects in our life for a variety of reasons. Maybe it's our upbringing. Maybe it's the world around us. Whatever it is, these things sometimes shape us in an improper way. And they get something wrong in us that we can't even control. We can't control the fact that these temptations are coming and that they're deep-seated and that they're difficult. They're going to be there. What we need to do is then say, we also have to realize, though, that there's something more in me. I have a freedom still. And I have a freedom to say no to acting out this way. I have a freedom to respect God's gift of my life to me so that I can say yes to it. Doesn't mean I'm going to do it perfectly. That's why we have the sacrament of reconciliation. But I'm willing to try. And I can just, again, speak from the friends who have struggled with this tendency, for example. They will all tell me, because they were used to, most of them used to be very heavy in that life. They have never been happier. Never. Being chaste. Because it means living a life, it means living your sexuality according to your state in life. So if you're married, you're being chaste when you're entering into the marital act with your partner. That's chastity. That's part of chastity. Chastity means I'm living out my sexuality. So I'm a celibate. I made that promise when I was ordained a deacon. Father is celibate as well. We made that promise. So that means I'm going to be single for the rest of my life. Which means I would never, hopefully, engage in any sexual activity because it's not proper to my state in life. Sexual activity is reserved to marriage for that end of procreating children. But these friends of mine, and they tell me, this is the interesting thing, they said when they were being promiscuous, when they were having sex over and over again with different partners, they felt used. Half the time they didn't even know the name of the person they were going home with. Sometimes some of them went home with two or three different people at night. And hearing the stories of the guys, some of the guys who came in through the hospice were obviously part of that culture. Same thing. Some of them had hundreds of sexual partners in their lifetime. Hundreds. They can't remember their names, and so on and so forth. And always and everywhere, again and again, I felt used. I felt I was just there for someone else's pleasure. It's not an easy thing to talk about. Our culture doesn't encourage us to talk about this, but these are the emotional facts. These are the real meat and potatoes that people are actually going through. Sometimes they may not be willing to encounter it in the moment, but it's not pretty. Yes, Meg?
Can we talk a bit about children conceived through artificial means? Can we talk a bit about children conceived through acts of violence?
Okay, so like rape.
Yeah.
Often you'll hear arguments against life of saying something to the effect of, well, about rape. It didn't involve her freedom. She didn't want to get pregnant, but she got pregnant anyways.
And it didn't involve marital rape.
It's violence. Exactly. No, and you're right. It's totally violent. How can we justify this? Again, as Louise said, when we're looking at the moral decisions, we have to take the whole picture into account. And as difficult, as heartbreaking as a situation like that might be, it's still a person in her womb. Still a human being. And again, actually I know this story personally from a friend. We have in my cathedral parish in Victoria, we have a woman, she runs a ministry where she helps out young married women, unmarried women usually, who are having unexpected pregnancies, and she counsels them, essentially. And she also finds the support system necessary so they can carry the children to term. One person came in there through rape. Again, not easy. And the child can still be even a reminder to her sometimes of what happened that night. But she sees that child as the greatest gift she's ever had. We have a tendency to restrict things to that moment, and we don't think of what could possibly down the road. And so often, because this is not, I mean, that's a personal case, what I've heard personally from, but I've also heard many other stories in this regard, where the mother found, they see this as the one good thing that came out of this. The one good thing. It's not to say this is easy again, it's horrific. I, as a man, I know I can't even contemplate what that would be like. I can't fathom it. But hearing these testimonies of these women who have gone through it, have chosen to keep their children, you see term, yeah, some of them will give them up to adoption, but even that sense of, maybe they'll have children later in life, for example. I've heard one story where they've had children later in life, and the joy that their children brought to them, they see, well, do what? I brought joy to that family by keeping my child. Because we have to remember, no matter how unfortunate the circumstances are in which the conception happens, it's still a child. And that's why we, as a church, as human beings, have that moral duty. It's a duty to support those people who find themselves in these unfortunate situations and to give them the emotional, the spiritual, the fraternal, and material. You need to give them the whole support necessary in the situation. We need to be there as friends for them through that. And we need to help them to give them anything they need so that that child can be brought to term. Yes?
One of the things that the so-called pro-choice people say is that, well, a woman should have the right to choose what she does in her own life.
Yeah.
You know, I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
Except, in the situation of a pregnancy, it's not just her own life.
Exactly.
They just totally ignore the fact that there's another person in there.
Yeah.
And so, it's overly simplistic to say, well, I can do what I want with my own life. Well, if it's all you and yourself by yourself, I guess you can.
Mm-hmm.
But when you've got that other child, when you've got that person, you know, and I found the best argument with pro-life is to say, when do you say self-life against? When do you say? Because if you say conception, then abortion is murder.
And we have to remember that when conception happens, it's not going to become a dog, it's not going to become like a tree, it's not going to become a cat, it's not going to become a cow. Everything in that moment of conception says this is a human being. Everything.
And is it morally different to take a morning after pill that will prevent conception?
Well, the church will always say it's never morally illicit to take contraception. It's never morally illicit. The church will always say it's, again, even in the case of rape, it's never, because first, the possibility of the morning after pill is more often, from what I understand, is more often an abortive patient. So it doesn't actually stop the conception. It kills what has been conceived. It doesn't allow it to implant. So, okay, Elise?
I just want to refer back to the woman on the mention on the internet. And her own mother tried to report her twice. God would have it. And she's given it. She said, am I less loved by God because my mother tried to kill me twice? No, I'm loved by God. I need to be, and I need to be reminded that it's a lovely thing.
Yeah.
Because they're on the internet.
Yeah. And we also need to remember, too, like, first, there are a lot of people who are starting to deal with the difficulties of abortion who come to maybe realize that this is wrong. Again, we need to be there for them. And so, like, for example, this person who runs this ministry, every single person that's come to see her has kept the child except for one person. She's seen over 40 families in the last year and a half, or 40 pregnant women. Only one. It's a great success rate, but still, for her, one is one too many. In that case, what does she do? Because what happened was the parents were pressuring, and the girl gave in to the parents' pressure. Afterwards, the girl was distraught. This woman who runs this ministry, she sees her still for counseling, and the parents also realize the wrong of their action, and they too come to her for counseling. So we still need to be that. It's unfortunate what happened, and you can never know all the conditions that are going through someone's mind when they're wanting to do this. So you have to refrain from being like, judgmental. Like, what you did was wrong and evil, and how dare you, blah, blah, blah. We need to be there to help them, to comfort them, to heal them, so that in the future they can make right. Because that's what? We all make wrong choices. We all make wrong choices. Every single one of us here have made wrong choices. And sometimes with some that deeply hurt people.
Yeah. Can I just come back to when you had said, Brian, about, I remember, I just had this conversation with Amanda, is that when I was a teenager, well not a teenager, probably young 20, coming to that understanding of wrestling with that abortion thing for myself, where do I stand on this, I immediately went, well, it's my own body. And then it occurred to me, wait a minute, and you said it to my belief, it isn't my own body. I'm the custodian of this body. This is God's body he gave to me to take care of. So that was point number one. And then point number two, in my own reasoning, I went, oh, and then there's another body within this body. So there are two reasons why I can't go for abortion. A, it's not my body. I have to be a good custodian to this body, but it's not mine. It'll be returned. Can I go to the subject?
Yeah.
Been here 15 times before. This is the one, every one of us is going to likely, God willing, have the privilege of being at our parents' deathbed.
Yeah.
And here's the thing, or solemnly not, here's the thing that all of us, like most of us hopefully will never have to deal with rape or abortion or whatever, but I think all of us will deal with the death of a loved one. And the business about it, and we touched on it a little bit, but if you talk to, what should we expect from the medical profession? What should we be telling the medical profession when our loved one is dying?
Right. What we always need to do is we need to give, as Louise kind of talked about in the talk, all those kind of necessary means for life. Food and water. So for example, just a case, there was actually, there's children who thought that feeding their mother was actually an extraordinary means and that they wanted to refuse her food. The court said no. It's an ordinary means of life. What's an extraordinary means? For example, a breathing machine. It's actually an extraordinary means of life. It's not, we don't need breathing machines to live. We need food to live. We need water to live. We need basic care to live. But if someone, so for example, if our parents, for example, say, I want the ordinary means, I don't want any extraordinary means, that's okay. The church says that's fine, because really, actually, we're meant to die naturally, and perhaps we've gone to almost to the other extreme where we almost expect all the extraordinary means so we can get a few extra months out of life. It's okay if our parents, like when my grandpa passed away a couple years ago, he didn't want any extraordinary means. He didn't want any emergency surgeries. He said he was ready to go. He didn't require any breathing apparatus, but if it was required, he could have refused it, and that's morally illicit because it's not about controlling his death. Naturally, he would take it. So, but if our parents were on a breathing machine and they kind of maybe expressed their desire to go off it, that's okay. That's okay. Where we can't refuse things is, like I said, those ordinary means. food insofar as it's possible. So, like, for example, when I was in San Francisco, one of the guys who was passing away was essentially unconscious for a week. We couldn't give him food. Not possible. We would moisten his mouth often. We'd put droplets of water in there to ensure that he could be as hydrated as we could keep him hydrated. But we couldn't give him food because he wasn't conscious to receive food. That's okay. That's normal means according to the situation. But we always have to ensure that we give them the ordinary means and to respect those ordinary means and then not to refuse them those ordinary means. Because really, it can be, like, even seeing these guys, you know, trying to get even water and stuff like that, it's torture to not have those ordinary means. It's torture. It makes it worse. So I think that's the best thing to take into account. Ordinary means are always necessary, and in the medical profession, you'll tend to find that most people will agree with this. If you don't do this, you're going to jail because it's considered a form of torture, essentially. So just make sure you're always, a pain management, yes.
In terms of intravenous TV, is that acceptable?
If it's possible. So, like, for example, in our place, we weren't legally allowed to give intravenous feeding. That's why it was not possible for us. But in the hospital, that's usually a normal means for giving nutrition, and that would usually be done, to my knowledge. Yes?
I'd like to ask you, like I said, I have some friends who were saying that they are real husband and wife.
Okay.
They have been trying for a long, long time, and yet the wife still could not conceive.
Yes.
And they found out that, you know, that it is due to some kind of a physiological
effect.
So, from that point of view, would it be okay for the actual husband and wife to have a fantastic baby?
Okay. The church, again, in this regard, has always said that we cannot have any conception. Always has to happen in a natural form. It's not to say this is not to put down the difficulties that go in with that. I was just learning today in my bioethics class, 10-15% of couples have difficulty or can never conceive. Not easy. Not easy at all. And why do they want to conceive? Because they see the child, usually, as an expression of their union, and they can't have that. But we also, again, remember my basic thing, everything's a gift. Everything's a gift. And sometimes we're not going to be, because we also have to remember too, we live in a fallen world. And because we live in a messy world, things do not always go the way we want them to. And we don't have a right to have whatever we want, whenever we want, however we want. Children are a gift, not a right. It's a gift. And so the church's teaching comes from that respect. But there's other ways to receive the gift. This is why, another reason why abortion is so unfortunate, because there are many couples like this who would love to have a child, who would love to adopt. They have to wait 10 years. They have to wait 5 years, because there's not enough children up for adoption. The reason the church's position is this way is because, first, we also have to remember that we allow technology to develop faster than our moral judgment. Benedict XVI was huge on this. He says, we've allowed technology to develop in such a pace that we haven't given time to really be able to develop a moral response to these technologies. We need to, because anything that can do something to us or that we can do, that's a moral action. And it requires our moral discernment on how that's going to affect us and others.
Sum that up with, just because we can, does that mean we should?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things that we can do, but does that mean we should?
Yeah.
And like I say, we need to really wrestle with it.
Yeah.
Especially advances in medicine, but it doesn't mean it's not really
advances
in medicine. I mean, in your own life, maybe you need a child care, just because you can, you know, step out of the house and bring home friends and mom and dad. Does that mean you should?
Exactly. Well, I might think too, like, just as a more basic example, not that this is like morally evil or anything, because I use it myself, but it's not morally, but social media develops at a hugely, insanely quick pace. We use it without even thinking about its possible effects on us. How has it affected us? someone you meet now, after 10 minutes, is now a friend. That has an effect. You have to think, what is the effect of my action? That we often think, again, because maybe we're a bit too individualistic in our culture, that every action I do is only going to affect me. Wrong, 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 wrong. That's the other reason I love Breaking Bad. It does a great... This is actually Vince Gilligan's point. He wanted to have a show. He says, too often you see crime dramas where they have the action, but you don't see the consequence. He says, I want people to see the consequence of moral action. At the end of season 2 or 3... No, maybe it was at the end of season 4 or 5. The great plane crash.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Why? He... Walter White chose to not save the girl who was choking from a drug overdose, whose father was so distraught over that, was unable to focus on his work, which was as an air traffic controller, which caused the crash. His moral action had a consequence in the lives of others. I mean, it's maybe a bit impossible, a bit fantastical, but it's meant to demonstrate a point. Everything we do, whether it's for good or for bad, has an effect on others. Everything. This is why the church... Now, we also have to remember, though, too, like, okay, we're talking a lot about morality here. Is the church all about morals? No. I'm going to give you my favorite quote of all time from Pope Benedict. Being Christian is not an ethical choice or a lofty idea. So it's not about ethics. It's not about ideas. But it's about an encounter with an event, a person, which gives life a new horizon and decisive direction. That's what being Christian, that's what being Catholic is all about. We encounter the person of Jesus Christ, who gives us a new way of looking at the world. And by looking at this world in this new way, we're able to then make these... It's not to say that moral judgments and ideas aren't important, but they fall under the purview of our relationship with the person of Jesus Christ.
They're
a consequence of our relationship with Jesus Christ. So if we want to choose Christ... We want to choose love. And think about it this way too. Look at the great saints. Look at the effects they've had on them. Look at Mother Teresa. That's what love does in the world. It has positive effects, not just on the people you serve, but also the people around you. And it starts to change the world around you. Yes, please.
Well, thank you. You know, we talk about that marriage. We talk a lot about all the letters and everything. But I'm a single person. Mm-hmm. And... You know, part of the book of my life is that not only have I got married and had to be having kids, but I think of it that way. I look at the fact that I was a teacher getting used to my career, I taught at school, and so that was incredibly enriching, and you know, I got to do lots of things with kids. You know, I'm an auntie, and I'm also able to look after somebody who has a lot of difficulty looking after himself, which I wouldn't be able to do if I'm around. So it's how you look at your life.
Exactly.
And it's thanking God for the beautiful gifts that we have in each of our locations.
Yeah.
We all have struggles.
Yeah.
We all have this incredible gift.
Exactly. We're going to have gifts. We're going to have struggles. Every single one of us. Because we all hate the cross. We don't need to go seeking out crosses because they're thrown in our life enough, I think. But what did Jesus do? When the cross is thrown his way, he struggled with it. But he said, Father, let not my will be done, but your will. And we always forget the redemptive power of saying yes to God. I'm writing, when we do finish our degree at the seminary, our Masters of Divinity, we have to do this thing called a synthesis project. And so right now I'm writing on the fall in my synthesis. Sorry, oh, the fall of Adam and Eve, when their fundamental disobedience to God. And the way I reflect on it is that they had this opportunity to say yes to God when they were threatened by the serpent. Because the word serpent in Genesis, it actually really means this like almost dragon-like figure. So they probably felt overwhelmed in the monstrosity of what was in front of them. Instead of looking to saying yes to God despite what was in front of them, instead of the suffering that might even come their way, they said no. They were disobedient. True freedom comes from letting... We see this in Jesus Christ. He's both human and divine. He's fully human. He's fully divine. For me, Christ is everything about understanding everything about Catholic doctrine. If you don't understand Christ, you won't understand Catholic doctrine, because it all makes perfect sense here. It's a fully human freedom. Human freedom like ours, limited, created, because he's human like us. He also has a divine freedom. And so every action of Jesus is his human freedom, assenting to his divine freedom, which is the will of his Father. Every action, he's saying yes to his Father. Yes, Father, I choose what you desire for me. And that's what he did in the garden. He said yes. Instead, like Adam said no, in front of the monstrosity of the serpent, Jesus said yes in front of the monstrosity of the cross. He switched it all around for us. And he's not just an example, but by virtue of our baptism, we actually participate in his yes to the Father. He gives us, our baptism gives us the ability to say yes to everything God asks of us. So that in those moments of suffering, when burden things happen in our lives, it doesn't mean our tendency wants to be to run away. That's our sinfulness. But the grace of baptism gives us the strength to say yes. Because if it was on our own, we can't do it. It's Jesus' yes working in us. That's the great power of baptism that just changes your whole life. And so when these moral and ethical life decisions come in front of us, we want to say yes to this consistent life ethic because it's the yes of Jesus to his Father. And we're participating in that yes. Because we're sharing the yes on the cross so that we can glorify God through the yes of the resurrection, where we say, yes, I'm willing to be raised up. I'm willing to live this new life that you've given me.
Unless you have that optic, mm-hmm. You see where the average Joe out there, you know, looks at the teachings of the church and thinks we're just completely lost.
Yeah.
Because unless you're seeing it through these lens, it doesn't make sense.
No, exactly.
It doesn't.
Exactly.
On a human level. On a strictly human level, a lot of it is just too difficult.
Yeah. Just, I don't know, as a kind of interesting kind of side note, for my bioethics paper, actually, I talked to the professor, I said, I want to talk about the concept of gift as determining ethical norms, because I think if the church can start to offer a natural response, a reasonable, like, the church is always offering a reasonable response, but sometimes in a way that the world can understand it. If you say, if we can start to see the phenomenon of gift in everything we do and act, then you can, even on a natural level, these norms will seem reasonable to people. So, I don't know.
Thank you so much.